You're listening to episode 10 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, my name is Claude 2 and this is the GNU World Order. I'm pretty sure it's episode 10. Honestly, I kind of forgot to look at the last one, so it could be 9, but I think it's 10. And in this episode, we're going to talk about some listener feedback-y kinds of tips. I mean, little stories that I ripped off from people in IRC and stuff, and I will share with you. I'm going to talk about the Indiana Linux Fest, and I'm going to talk about the concept of features versus bells and whistles, and also some command line multimedia tools, I think. So that sounds like a lot, so we should probably get started. Indiana Linux Fest, simply because it's right at the front of my mind. The Indiana Linux Fest happened last weekend. The Northeast Linux Fest is happening this coming weekend. I originally was intending to go to both, and the Indiana Linux Fest, I mean, it makes me want to go to another one really, really badly, actually, so I would love to go to the Northeast Linux Fest. I completely intended to go to the Northeast Linux Fest. I told Pokey from IRC that I was going to be at the Northeast Linux Fest at the HPR table. I really, really expected to be there, but something has come up. I have to go help a friend in a completely different city in the opposite direction, so I'm just not going to be able to make the Northeast Linux Fest. But I've talked to the organizer of, or one of the organizers of Northeast Linux Fest. I've apologized for it. I wasn't scheduled to give a talk or anything, so it's not like I'm ducking out on anything important, but I really did want to be there, and things happen, and the Indiana Linux Fest really was cool, so I did get my little fix of the Linux Fest thing, at least for the next month or so. Indiana Linux Fest was really, really well done, really, really well executed. Couldn't believe how actually well done it was. Seemed like they just had the organizers, I don't know how much, or the volunteers, rather, I don't know how long those volunteers have been working on this, but I mean, it just seemed like everyone knew exactly what to do. Everyone seemed to know the answer to everything. It was really, really strange. It was like a theme park or something, you know? I mean, you go in and you ask anyone in a green shirt any question, and they know the answer. It was really, really bizarre. They had a great AV guy there, a dedicated AV guy who was, I guess he must have had a couple of separate rigs, I don't really know, but he was videotaping some stuff and recording some stuff straight into computers and then dumping them out somewhere, I don't really know. It was just all so well coordinated, so well put together. I was really impressed. And I guess, all of this sounds pretty typical, right? I mean, OLF, self, that's how these things work, right? Well, not necessarily. That's how these things are supposed to work. So the fact that Indiana Linux Fest being the first year festival and stuff like that came off so well, I really thought highly of it. I was impressed. Probably part of me being so impressed and excited would be also that I talked there. I gave a 5-hour talk. It was a lesson plan of sorts on Friday about multimedia tools and Linux, and that went really, really well, I think. It's really hard to judge in the moment or retrospectively how well it all went. I was told it went well. I'm hoping it did. I'm hoping that people listening to the talks got a lot out of it. It's you know, obviously when you're giving a talk, you're always trying to please. You would like in the best of all possible worlds to please everyone at the talk. You want to make sure that everyone at the talk gets exactly what they came to the talk for. So you're trying to do all of these, you're trying to predict what they actually want, and I just flat out asked, but not every new module. So I kind of got a feel for where the people were in their little multimedia exploration, and I tried to address all of what I could imagine their, you know, where they were. I tried to address all those issues and kind of come at it from that angle. I don't know how well that worked, but that was my intent, and it went well. I mean, I had a good feeling about it. I covered GIMP, I covered Inkscape, I think we took a lunch then, and then I covered Synfig Studio, which is that animation package I mentioned, I think, in the last episode. And then I talked about music and video. The music and video session, I felt really, really suffered, because it was the fourth and the fifth hour, and at that point, I was starting to get pretty tired, I think. I'm just talking about stuff I like, but I think my brain was starting to shut down a little bit, unfortunately. So, happily, for me, one of the speakers the next day, Saturday, wasn't able to make the talk. I mean, it's a guy from This Week in Linux. It's a video cast that you can find on YouTube. And I think his name is Jordan. And he wasn't able to make his talk. I probably got his name wrong. But anyway, he does a great little video cast about This Week in Linux. It's on YouTube. You can find it. I'll link to it if I remember in the show notes. And he got sick, which is understandable because actually food in Indiana seems to really be very bad. It's very bland and it probably made him ill. I'm not sure the details actually, but anyway, he wasn't able to make his talk, which is a pity for him, but they asked me to give a talk in his place, which really made me nervous because I thought, well, everyone's going to his talk to see something, you know, to see a talk about Kdean Live because that's what he uses and it looks great. Here I am using command line stuff and Blender, but it turned out really, really great. I went through installing drivers for your camera, pulling off footage from those cameras. I ventured to try to give a live demo by turning on my webcam, which I don't even use. I never use my webcam. I didn't even know I had drivers installed for it, but I did that and it actually worked right there in front of everyone. That's not supposed to happen. Demos are supposed to fail. Basically everything on this demo worked. So it really, really worked out well. I feel like a lot of people got a lot out of it. I think people, you know, got a lot of information out of it. I don't know how many of them will actually use the command line in Blender to edit their videos, but I think it went well. I also got to show off a little tiny bit of Auteur just as a video splicing tool, so that was good. And it's really good to reinforce those basic ideas of video editing workflow about how you're supposed to really look through your footage first, find the good stuff, and then bring that into your, you know, the sequence editor, the thing that's going to line all those clips up into a sensible order and make that into a larger work. So I was able to kind of convey that both visually and I think people got that. I think that came through. And seeing Blender 2.56, it just the interface is so much nicer. It's just a beautiful application. And so I think seeing that and seeing, yeah, you can throw video in here, you can put a transition on it. It's not hard. It's not insurmountable. You can actually do it. And then we exported the video, and it worked. Again, it just everything was working. It was really bizarre. Never works that way in demos, but it did that time. So, yeah, great, great festival. I highly recommend it next year. It was a lot of fun. I got to meet Delta Ray, who's this guy who does the command line magic Twitter feed and something else. I think, I'm sure an Identica feed, something else. I think there's one. Oh, an RSS feed. That's just a normal RSS feed, I think. Really great stuff. I attended his talk. It was all about the command line, obviously, and he threw out all kinds of tips. It was really cool. I got to see Verbal again and Mrs. Verbal. Verbal actually did a talk on Web2Py. Listened to HPR for my interview with him about that. It was a good fest. It was really cool. Well done. A lot of fun. Okay, enough of Indiana Linux Fest, I think. Let's move on to SSH-copy-ID. Now, this is a tip that Rowing Golfer in IRC gave me one time. I don't remember why, but he just kind of threw it out there. And at first, I kind of ignored him because, you know, people are always trying to give you shortcuts on ways to do things that already are perfectly easy to do anyway. Then I tried it, and I was totally sold. It's a simple command. It's on Linux. It's not something that you're going to find on every Unix box, but it was on Slackware and Fedora and Debian, so it's on the big ones. And it's simply a way for you to copy your SSH key to another computer of yours, or a computer that you have access to. And it simply quickly and easily does that. So instead of doing a less or a cat on your public ID SSH key, you simply, and then, you know how you'd do a cat on that, and you'd copy it, and then you'd SSH into your server, and you'd open up the .ssh/knownhosts file, and then you'd paste that in there, right? That would be normally how you get your key onto that server. Far easier to do this. You simply, if you're on your computer and you know you have an SSH key, and if you don't, you can use SSH-keygen or genkey, I forget which way it is, but you know you've got one, so you do SSH-copy-ID, and then for instance, space clat2@192.168.5.54, and it takes care of the rest. It SCPs your little key over into that computer. It cats it into the .ssh/knownhosts file, and then it confirms with you that it's done that and tells you to promptly log in just to make sure that it all works and that you didn't copy stuff along the way that you didn't mean to, i.e. through a man-in-the-middle attack or whatever, I guess. So it's just one command, and it just gets your identity over onto that computer, or your SSH, you know, credentials, I guess, over onto that computer. And then from then on, you can always just SSH over to there without doing anything. You just do SSH 192.168.5.45 or 5.4, whatever, and you'll just log in. Really, really quick, really fast, really easy. It's been one of those commands that once I finally tried it, it stopped making sense to do anything else other than that. It was just, why would I ever copy and paste my public key again? So I wanted to cover, before the coffee break, which of course is coming up, I wanted to cover a couple of command line multimedia tools that I've been using a little bit here and there lately, simply because talking with the last known god at ILF, and we were kind of talking about how handy those little command line multimedia tools were. And it's funny that I guess we must have come to that conclusion at roughly the same time, because I've got this little media box in my office. You'll remember it from the MPD episode that I did. It's kind of sitting off in a corner, and it's hooked into the network, and it's got a static IP address. I SSH into it quite often, and it's my media box. So if someone gives me a CD of their band or something like that, then I'll pop it into that box and rip it straight into my master music library, essentially. And it's handy. It's good to have, but there's no GUI on it. It's just mainly a music and a podcatcher and, you know, a processor for, like, if I want to compile something on that and then send it over to another computer, one of my other little computers, I'll do that. And it's got DiskCC on there for the other G4 boxes that I've got in here. So it's that kind of box. It's not a fancy GUI kind of media server or anything like that. And it's not a prepackaged media server. It doesn't have menus and screens that you can boot into little kiosk modes. It's not like that. On that computer, I use a couple of different commands quite frequently, and I just wanted to kind of relay them to you in case you didn't know about them. The first one I thought of was ABCDE. Yes, that's actually the command. It's a little program. It's a shell script, which is really cool because it's really nicely done. And it stands for A Better CD Encoder, ABCDE. It's that simple. You pop in your CD into the drive, you type in ABCDE, and it auto-detects it pulls from, you know, the CDDB database or whatever, the titles of the tracks and the artists of that CD. It asks you if you need to override those, or if it's a compilation, you can override it or reclassify it as you desire, and then you tell it to start ripping, and it rips everything first to WAV and then transcodes it for you to OGG, and you end up with a perfectly ripped CD on your hard drive without ever having to open any GUI application at all. It's a wonderful, wonderful application. The other one, of course, Handbrake, the command line version. I'm not going to go really, really deep into that because I think we're all familiar with it. You may or may not know that there's a command line version, but the Handbrake command line version is what I use all the time. I can't be bothered with the GUI. It's just too easy to use the command line version. Handbrake, in some distributions, you'll see it called Handbrake-CLI, maybe Handbrake-CLI. It might be Handbrake all capital CLI. You'll just have to kind of explore that on your own. Best way to do that is apropos Handbrake. So Handbrake on the command line has a bunch of presets. It's either the -V or the -lowercase z. I always forget which one. So if you just type in Handbrake CLI -V, it'll give you a list of all the presets. And then you can do Handbrake CLI-Z and then whatever preset name you want to use, and it will rip whatever device you're pointing it at in whatever format you've asked it to. Very, very cool. Another one that is quite nice and quite multilingual is called LXDVDRIP. I can't say that I favor this one over Handbrake or vice versa. I do know that I tend to seem to use Handbrake more often, but I think that's just because that was what I knew first. But LXDVDRIP is, it feels a little bit like a shell script. It's probably not, but it's a command line, and it's fairly interactive. The only thing with that one is that you have there is a config file that you'll probably want to configure. And one of the most important things is that by default, it's set to /dev/sr0, which I think under normal circumstances on every other computer, that would be fine. On the PowerPC 64 Debian box that I have, that's not what it is. It's my DVD, my optical drive comes up as /dev/cd-rom1. So I kind of have to overwrite it in the config file for lxdvd-rip. But once you do that, it works really, really easily. And then finally, two new little multimedia apps that I found recently that I can't really... Well, they're not command line applications, so I guess this is a new segment technically, but it all kind of fits, so I'm not going to play any segue music. So there's Bombono, B-O-M-B-O-N-O, which is a DVD authoring program, which is really, really slick, really, really easy to use, very nice. Another similar one to that would be DVD Styler. You should check that one out too. These are both, to me, just incredible programs because they're GUI, because, I mean, in order to get the DVD laid out with menus and stuff like that, you kind of got to do it. But they're just so nice. They're so nice. My only previous experience with DVD authoring had been, I think, Q DVD Author or something like that, which, of course, is fairly famous. I mean, it's been around for a long time, I think, and it's worked very well for a lot of people. But honestly, it was just over complex for me. I'm not really into the whole authoring DVD thing when authoring means let's design fancy menus and all this other stuff. I'm more of the type of person who says, well, let's skip DVDs altogether, but if we have to, we'll burn it, but let's just make it really simple so that you put the disc in and it plays the movie, because that's what people want. They don't want your fancy little menus that look like websites from 1998. They just want to watch a movie. So that's just my opinion. Anyway, those are both cool. And Arista is another ripper, actually. Again, it's not command line, but it's a Python GStreamer ripper, and it's really, really pretty. It's really nice. I think if people saw it, they would think that it was a real live application. You know, it's just, it looks nice. It behaves well. I recommend it. It's got presets in a drop-down menu. It auto-detects your DVD drive, and you can even use it, in theory, to record stuff off of your webcam, I found out. I also found out that it only picks up, like, every 5 frames if you're doing it on a really old computer, but I don't think that's really the fault of Arista. I think it's the computer I was running it on. But it is a really nicely, it's well laid out. You can make your own presets and then load them in after you make them. It's really cool. And then easy install, too. It's a Python app. Make sure you've got all the dependencies, and then you run Python setup.py install, I think, and that installs it for you. Okay, I think it's probably time for a cup of coffee. So let's go get one. We'll come right back here and get on with the show. Segment on features versus bells and whistles. And this is something that I've been thinking about fairly often recently, and a guy in the GIMP session, if I recall correctly, actually kind of brought this back to the front of my mind, because I'd been thinking about it for a while, but then I kind of laid off. But then he asked a question about GIMP, and he just kind of asked, like, is there any catch, you know, is there, and that's not his, he didn't phrase it exactly like that, but essentially he was asking, why does Photoshop exist if GIMP is good enough, or is there anything that you might need in Photoshop that you just don't have in GIMP, you know, is there any reason not to use GIMP? That was the gist of the question. And someone else at the fest later on said that it, you know, they were looking at Synfig, and they said, wow, it really looks like, I think that such and such an app has more features than or is a more powerful application than Synfig. And that kind of, it almost kind of offended me a little bit, because I thought, well, how can you say that? You know, Synfig is such a great application. And so I really thought about it. I really, really thought about it, and I realized that there are two different categories of what we look for in applications, I think. One of those things are features. What features does the application have? A feature would be something like, if you're designing a DVD authoring program, for instance, do you have the ability to have a play button on your menu so that you can actually implement the movie that you want to watch? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. If you don't have that as a feature, your DVD authoring program probably isn't going to be very popular. Now, a bell and a whistle would be something more like if your DVD authoring program also has the ability to automatically divide your entire movie up into somewhat fairly intelligent chapter markers. It's cool, you know? I mean, if your authoring program can scan through the video file in a very quick fashion, kind of auto-detect really drastic scene changes, and place chapter markers at each scene, that would be cool. That's a neat feature, in theory. But I don't think that that's a feature. And so, what's the difference between this feature and this other thing that I'm insisting is not a feature? Well, for me, a feature is something that goes toward doing the thing that you claim your application is supposed to do. While these other things, these automated sort of make it easy on you sorts of things, I really don't think those are fairly called features. Those are just other things that the application does. It's not really necessary. If you don't have that thing, your application is still going to do what it says does, which is author a DVD for you. And to make it even better or worse or whatever, you can hack around it. Hack is even too strong a word. You can do it manually. If the DVD authoring program that you're using does not have auto detection of all your chapters, then you can go through and make your own chapters. It doesn't really matter. And it could even be argued that in many of these cases, you're going to have to go redo it anyway. There's that kind of, I guess we'll just call it a bell or a whistle, where you get something automated. You press a button and it does something for you. And then the catch, the eternal catch, is that you still have to go back through and make sure that it did it correctly. So are you really saving that much time anyway? You know, if you're clicking a button and it's auto-detecting your chapters, and yet you have to go through, visually verify that those chapters are what you think looks good and appropriate, and possibly even manually correct a couple that weren't right, then you've just done exactly what that little magic button claims to be saving you from having to do. Same thing goes with, for instance, automagical font collection. Some applications out there, like Scribus, for instance, they look at your document and they gather all the fonts that you're using for you, and they offer to embed it in the document. And that's a really handy thing. But you know, I've never once exported a document from Scribus and not manually verified the fonts. You know, I mean, it's just not something that I do. I mean, I don't go back through the whole document and look at every font, because I know that Scribus is doing that for me. But I still have to go through and look and make sure that all the fonts that I think I've used are actually being reflected in Scribus. And then I have to manually move some of them over from either embed or just tracing over the fonts. So it's a great bell and whistle. I'm not going to say that it's not. It's something that I appreciate, something that makes my life easier. But if it went away, I would be fine with that, because I don't depend on it anyway. I refuse to depend on it because I don't really trust it. It's too automated. So these are bells and whistles, and then there are features. And the features, like I say, are the things that are in your application that go very directly toward doing what you're claiming your application is supposed to do. And if you don't have that feature, then your application isn't any good yet, and it shouldn't be considered stable. So I don't think that we as computerists, as geeks, as people who think about this sort of thing, and who people talk to about these things, I don't think we should do ourselves or the free software world the disservice of accepting the fact that people are blending bells and whistles in with features, because I simply refuse to accept the fact that, you know, something like, I don't know, even auto face detection in a photo management software. It's really cool. It's really neat. And actually, a lot of the free ones, most of the free ones, I think, have that now. But it's actually, I think a lot of the free ones actually do have that now. But, you know, whatever. I mean, it's a cool feature. It's a cool bell and whistle. It's a cool feature. It's a cool thing that it does. But in no way is that something that is necessary for a photo manager to do. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have it. I'm simply saying that if someone's comparing an application to another application, and all that they can really do are identify little bells and whistles that one doesn't have and the other does have, we should probably call them out on that. We should, not defensively, of course, not angrily, but we should identify those things. We should point out that certain things are, yeah, they're nice to have. You know, it's nice to be able to group layers into a little folder and then move that folder around, and inherently you are moving all those groups around. That's a really great feature. I love it in Synfig. I loved it in Photoshop when I used to use Photoshop. I miss it in the GIMP, but it hasn't slowed me down. And that's, I think, a big part of what a feature and a bell and whistle are to one another. A feature is going to help you get your work done. A feature is something that actually is necessary for you to get your work done. The bell and whistle, I don't think it typically, at least that I can think of, actually has an impact on the time one way or the other. It has the illusion of being faster because you clicked one button, many things happened, and then, of course, like I say, you probably go back through and manually verify that what you think happened really did happen. Or if not, then probably the thing that you did isn't very important and you could have done it manually just as easily. That's what I've found. I've done this many times. I mean, there are little things like layer effects, shadow layers, sort of meta layers that kind of attach themselves onto other layers. GIMP doesn't have quite the same sort of structure as, for instance, Photoshop did, but it honestly hasn't slowed me down. Not at all. I can use GIMP, I can apply shadows, I can flatten things, I can group them with little chain links instead of folders, all that stuff. Doesn't slow me down, not one bit. So identifying what actually affects your workflow and what simply modifies it but doesn't necessarily, you know, there's slowing you down, and then there's just saying here were your original set of steps and here's your modified set of steps. If it all comes out to be basically equal, that's not a feature that we're missing. It's just a way, it's a different way of doing things. And I think it's a very important concept to grasp, because I'm still grasping that with video editing. With the GIMP, I've grasped it. For some reason, that was a really easy transfer. I think it was probably because I used to hate Photoshop even when I used Photoshop. Really good in it, and I was certified, but I just never liked it. So I guess jumping ship to GIMP was not so terrible for me. It was actually quite exciting. I don't love alternative video editing applications that aren't running on Linux and are not free software, so I guess the same thing could more or less be true. But I was comfortable with the workflow. I knew how things were done. I knew how I was taught to do things. I'm familiar with it. I'm familiar with what an entire industry basically is familiar with. So it's very difficult for me to wrap my mind around the idea that things are going to be done differently on this platform. But you get used to it. You know, you sit down and you adjust your brain and you think of a different way of doing the same thing, and you realize that it's not necessarily, that it is not at all a bad way of doing things or a worse way of doing things. It's just literally, it's simply a different way of doing things. And, you know, if you want to go into the whole debate club thing, you can sit down and debate all kinds of things, that managing your clips of video in your file manager is actually a smarter way of doing things, because then you're actually assigning real paths to all of, to where they live, and then you can bring them into your video editor, and you've got absolute paths of where everything actually does live, and you're not just letting your little video editing application scatter them all around and just draw them in from all possible sources without you really understanding where your project files actually exist, so that when you go to back that project file up, you're not hunting all over your computer for that one little file that you had included in the video editor, but you hadn't included in your file system, so it doesn't really quite match up. You know, all these problems that are inherent with the way that really we all accept things are done, you can argue against them all day. You can also argue against the manual labor stuff too, because yeah, it's different. It takes thought. It takes an adjustment of how you're doing things, of how you're making things happen for yourself. But you know, that's not the worst thing in the world. That's what people learn every day when they come to Linux. They learn that just because they were familiar with one way of doing things, and maybe they liked it, maybe they didn't like it, maybe they liked one part about it and didn't like another part about it, it wasn't ever the only way to do things. It wasn't ever the only right way of doing things. It was just a way of doing something, and that if they sit down and apply themselves and want to learn free software and want freedom in the way that they compute, then they will do that, and that's what they'll get. They'll get freedom. Simple as that. No more worrying about your data being locked up by some other company, no other subservience to an external company that can charge you anything they want to, and the satisfaction of participating in a community that's making things happen by direct action. All of us are building something together, making it work. That's really good stuff. It's really exciting. And yeah, that's what I think about features. And I encourage you to keep them in mind. Keep the difference in mind, because I guarantee you people are going to ask you, you know, why a program doesn't do one thing a certain way, and they'll probably say something under their breath about how backwards this seems, when probably it's not really backwards, it's just different, and they're not used to it yet. Okay, I think that's honestly about all I've got for this episode, so thanks for listening, thank you for hanging out with me at the Indiana Linux Fest if you were there. Be sure to check out hackerpublicradio.org for my two Indiana Linux Fest interviews upcoming. And, of course, you can always contact me via email at clat2@hackerpublicradio.org or something like that, or clat2@fff.member.org. You can get to me on Jabber with notclat2@jabber.org. That's like IM and stuff like that. You can find my website at ogcastplanet.org/New World Order. You can, what else can you do? You can email me, I said that already. Oh, IRC. That would be freenode.net in the Ogcast Planet channel, in the Slacker Media channel, in the Slackware channel, places like that. So thanks for listening, and I will talk to you later.
Pay for coffee? Coffee should be free for everyone to take as they please.